project where he grew up. I know what the stuff actually tastes like, he explained. Who else you got here has that skill? At age 24, while working as a janitor at City Hall, he decided to run for the Cambridge City Council after finding out the government had to give matching funds to anyone who declared themselves a candidate and got 100 people to sign a petition of support. He got the signatures and used his funds to print up Fuck the Kennedys, Vote for Lenny Clark bumper stickers. The Kennedys were not involved in this particular political contest. Lenny just wanted to get everyone's attention, which he did. The city council asked for their money back. He then ran on a promise to clean up City Hall. During that same election, he stole a city bus and drove around to random bus stops, picking people up and driving each of them right to their front doors, all the while asking for votes while making them laugh their asses off. The whole thing ended in a police chase, and Lenny finishing 15th out of 36 candidates while being allowed to keep his janitorial job, proving there's no such thing as bad publicity and that Lenny Clark is a man of his word. At age 33, his affection for cocaine reached the point where he felt a burning curiosity to research how the product was manufactured. So he flew to Colombia and started asking around. They thought he was a cop. End of research. He stayed for a week and drank his hotel out of whiskey and tequila. At age 35, he invented an alcohol concoction named the Lenny Clark Carnival, a nod to his talent for always winning the top shelf prize in amusement park shooting games. The carnival is still available today. Here's how you can get one. Walk into any drinking establishment and tell the bartender to take a pint glass and pour equal amounts of all the expensive booze bottles on the top shelf into it. Once the bartender hands you this expensive mixture, you down it in two gulps, maybe three. I sipped the carnival once. Know what it tasted like? NyQuil, the original Green Death flavor. Warning, do not ingest cocaine and pizza after drinking the Lenny Clark Carnival, unless your name is Lenny Clark. At age 37, Lenny informed me that he'd read his first book, which was Merv, the best-selling autobiography of talk show host and game show creator Merv Griffin. Someone had left it on an airplane, and Lenny read it cover to cover while flying from L.A. to New York on a red-eye Coke binge. This would not only qualify him as a speed reader, but also quite possibly the least informed friend I'd ever had. When I asked him how he got through high school without ever reading a single thing, he admitted he was dyslexic. The words and letters he saw on paper or the blackboard became jumbled and switched around. In order to memorize lines for his sitcom, he had to pace back and forth on a beach while his ex-wife read the lines out loud and he implanted the dialogue into his brain. The flight back from L.A. was the first time in his life Lenny was able to read something word for word. So in a strange way, Lenny actually was a doctor because he unearthed a major medical breakthrough. Cocaine cures dyslexia. At age 44, Lenny was acting in an independent film being shot in Boston, showing up on time for work each day, but partying his fat ass off every night. On the final day of shooting, when a fellow actor mentioned the rap party that was taking place that very night at an old church, Lenny bought an 8-ball of blow and a pint of whiskey and headed on over. Having been at the famed Limelight Club in New York City, Lenny thought it was about time Beantown had an old church that was turned into a disco. Figuring this party would be an all-night rave, he had rigged his Coke in a small glass bullet bottle for easy access. Upon entering the church club, he saw about 200 people in the pews and took a seat in the back, sucking down some booze while sucking up some nose candy. There was a guy standing at the pulpit explaining what Lenny thought were the party rules. "My name is Bobby and I'm an alcoholic," he said. The crowd responded as one. "Hello, Bobby." "Holy shit," Lenny thought. "This is going to be my kind of fucking night, a whole room full of total party animals." As Bobby continued to talk about drinking a quart of whiskey a day, using cocaine, getting into bar fights and blacking out, Lenny was very impressed. "I gotta meet up with this guy later on," he thought. "We are gonna be best fucking friends." He did another bump, swallowed another shot. Then Bobby mentioned the last time he had a drink or a drug, which was 5 years previously. Everybody applauded, except Lenny. He turned to a woman sitting next to him and said, "Hey, what time does the party start?" She replied, "It never ends. That's why we're all here. This is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous." Lenny was aghast. He left in a huff, bitching to himself about the turncoat actor who played a prank on him. Back at his hotel, Lenny proceeded to drink and snort himself into oblivion. The next morning, it all somehow sank in. An empty bottle of whiskey and the clumped remnants of white powder stuck to a tabletop were harsh signposts he'd woken up to a million times before. His face was a red wreck. His head was pounding. But in between pumping boozy blood through his cocaine-infested veins, his fatty heart stopped sinking as he suddenly came to realize. The actor had actually done him a favor. He tossed the bottle and took a long shower, thinking back on all the wasted days and brain cells. That night, he went back to the church, still hungover but completely sober, and sat in on his first full meeting as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It felt like a new beginning. Don't worry, I got his permission to tell that story. He's been clean and sober for 20 years as of this writing. Not only that, he turned his whole life around. The moment of clarity he gained from that drunken church visit turned into a world tour. Lenny attends mass in churches around the globe whenever he's on location for a movie, TV show, or stand-up performance. He also donates countless dollars on each and every church visit. After 10 years of sobriety, Lenny also set out on a weight loss program, ultimately dropping almost 200 pounds. Today, he is a svelte buck 85 and a happy guy who has saved many lives by preaching the gospel of AA, including mine. 10 years ago, he helped me get sober and has been a touchstone of guidance and support ever since. Whenever I reach out, in person or by phone, he's always there, and his unrelenting desire to help others has extended into many other avenues. He doesn't want me writing about that stuff, but you know what? Fuck him. I'm telling you this to prove how a person can change through the power of a 12-step program. This is a partial list of the organizations he helps raise money for every year, as well as hosting or performing at each group's annual charity events. Massachusetts General Hospital, the Joey Fund, the Jimmy Fund, the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, the Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Foundation, now known simply as Susan G. Komen, the Seals Family Foundation, the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, the Light Foundation, the Cam Neely Foundation for Cancer Care, the Michael J. Fox Foundation, the David Ortiz Children's Fund, the Boston Bruins Alumni Association, the McCourt Foundation, the Mark Bavis Leadership Foundation, the FDNY Foundation, the Leary Firefighters Foundation, and far too many more to list here. His calendar is so jammed with charity events, he rarely has a week without one. I've personally never known an individual who donates as much of his time and energy to such kind and selfless work every single day of the year. Plus, I'm pretty sure it's not really that selfless after all. I think he's trying to do a ton of good stuff now just to make up for the 9 million bad things he did during the evil part of his life. His answer to that charge? You bet your ass I am. If there is a heaven, I want to make sure I get a good seat. My cousin Jerry Lucy's obituary described him as, quote, a firefighter's firefighter, unquote. The ultimate compliment that can be paid from one member of the fire service to another. Jerry served our hometown department in Worcester, Massachusetts, and gave his life in the line of duty on December 3, 1999, only a few city blocks from the main south neighborhood where we grew up. That day dawned cold and clear in Worcester. Jerry was working out of a downtown firehouse with Rescue One. Nearby, a guy who grew up across the street from me and was my classmate for 12 years at St. Peter's Catholic School was leading Ladder 2 that night. Lieutenant Tommy Spencer. Some 30-plus guys from the old neighborhood had chosen to become members of the Worcester Fire Department, answering the call to save others as their full-time job. Meanwhile, two homeless people had holed up in an abandoned building near the elevated expressway, just a short distance from both firehouses. The Worcester Cold Storage Warehouse was a brick behemoth, 6 stories high and occupying one full city block. It had no windows above the second floor. And inside it was a maze of connected meat lockers, the walls and ceilings coated with layers of cork, tar, expanded polystyrene foam, and spray-applied polyurethane. It was flammable to supreme levels, so when the couple knocked over a candle and some nearby newspapers caught fire, it escalated quickly. They made a split-second decision to run away. Meanwhile, an off-duty firefighter traveling down the expressway noticed gray smoke coming from the roof and called it in. Moments later, Rescue 1, Ladder 2, and Engine 3 responded. pulling up to the building and hearing from a local business owner and witness that two homeless people had recently been seen squatting there, they ran inside. Jerry and his partner, Paul Brotherton, led a search of the upper floors. Several other firefighters looked through the bottom three. Chief Mike McNamee described what happened next. There was a light smoke condition in the upper levels of the building, he said, to the point where we didn't even have our face pieces on. Within 4 seconds, it went from that to hot, black, boiling smoke. Mike called for everyone to immediately exit the building. A head count revealed that Jerry and Paul were missing. They radioed for help, confused about their exact location. Tommy Spencer then insisted on rushing in with firefighters Jay Lyons, Joe McGurk, and Tim Jackson alongside him to find Jerry and Paul. Moments later, the building exploded into what would be described as a massive brick oven of smoke and flame. The top four floors collapsed down onto the first two. And all hell broke loose. The building became an inferno. A surge of ladder companies and engine teams rolled in and shot water at a blaze that burned for days on end. The massive orange flames and rancid smoke filled the skies for miles around. It took a full week and a half to put out the fire and find the bodies, with teams of firefighters arriving from around the country and the world to dig into the hot stack of rubble. In the cold black winter nights, in the icy blue December days, an army of firefighters sifted through the steaming ash in search of bone fragments, the steel heads of scorched axes, teeth, badges, any sign of their fallen brothers. With Christmas just around the corner, this frigid battle they fought captured the attention of Americans from every corner of the country. Money poured in from each state, with individuals and organizations reaching out to help the widows and family members. Messages of support and prayers for discovery were daily arrivals. Bags of letters and envelopes containing checks and cash were sorted at fire headquarters. Each night became a desperate wait for the end of a story everyone already knew to be deeply, tragically sad. In a true display of the vast brotherhood that bonds firefighters together, men from departments far and wide worked 24/7 in shifts full of brute strength and fine detail, literally moving a broken brick mountain inch by horrible inch, refusing to quit until they found evidence of Jerry, Paul, Tommy, Joe, Jay, and Tim. The national media came to call them the Worcester Six. Their memorial service at the Worcester Centrum was attended by 14,000 people inside the arena and 25,000 more outside. President Clinton and Senator Ted Kennedy eulogized them as heroes. American flags were majestically folded and offered to their wives and parents. It was a somber yet spiritually uplifting goodbye. Some firefighters describe heavy fire as, quote, the bitch, unquote, and it was that type of challenge Jerry loved most. He was a truck guy. In fire department terminology, that means the people who run in first, the rescue teams, the bravest of the brave. But on December 3rd, 1999, all six of these men displayed a courage few of us have within our hearts. Searching for missing citizens in a torching terror of heat and smoke, then going on a more dangerous mission to save each other under even worse conditions. They left behind an entire nation praising such remarkable valor. They also left 17 children without fathers. Jerry died doing what he loved best. Firefighting wasn't just a job for him, it was his life's calling. He was an active presence on the Massachusetts Fire Department Hazardous Waste Material Team, a proud member of the Worcester Fire Department Honor Guard, and a teacher at the Massachusetts Firefighting Academy. When he wasn't spending time with his wife, Michelle, and two sons, Jerry and John, he was helping other firefighters get better training and finding new ways to improve his own performance skills. Jerry's legacy lives on in his son, Jerry, who is now a member of the Worcester Fire Department. Four of Paul Brotherton's sons are also Worcester firefighters. So is one of Tommy Spencer's boys. Six new young men in bunker gear, inspired by the passion of their dads. There's a wonderful symmetry in such a devoted tribute. Meanwhile, the Worcester Cold Storage Warehouse has been replaced with a new firehouse on the same site, from which Rescue One still races to alarms each and every night. That may be the greatest tribute of all, because it's exactly how Jerry would want to be remembered. There is a marvelous stone and bronze monument to the Worcester Six in front of that firehouse, but the doors flying open and their rigs roaring out speaks more closely to the heart and soul of my cousin. If he had survived the Worcester Cold Storage Warehouse fire that freezing December night, if he had walked out of the building alive, and another alarm sounded for a second fire in a nearby three-decker, he would have pulled up, jumped off the rig, and been the first guy to run inside. It's who he was, a man of action, a beast in the bitch, a firefighter's firefighter. There you have it, 12 Americans who changed the communities they live in, who managed to do good deeds when faced with personal demons, tremendous odds, and even death. People who decided to overcome obstacles by offering up their time, their blood, sweat, and tears to make a difference. I'm not going to tell you which political candidates they voted for or which parties they may have supported now or in the past. Some of them you can Google. Some of them you can't. And some of them I never even thought of asking, because none of that bullshit matters. Fire doesn't care who you voted for. Parkinson's doesn't attack based on political affiliation. Cancer is out to kill everyone on both sides of the aisle. Disease, disaster, and physical disability are all bipartisan issues. They suck hard. These 12 people have already made them suck way less than they used to. Try and filibuster that. If one morning I left the Oval Office, headed down to the Potomac River, and walked across the top of the water, all the way to the other side, the headline that afternoon would read, "President Can't Swim." LBJ. Fake news, real guns. During the last election cycle, a man from North Carolina with an internet addiction and a history of drug and alcohol problems believed the online fake news theory claiming John Podesta and Hillary Clinton were running a pedophile sex slave operation out of a Washington, D.C. pizza shop. So, he drove 7 hours to Comet Ping Pong, entered the restaurant, and fired several shots from his AR-15 before being subdued by police. The subsequent real news headlines were all about how insane it was for someone to buy into such a clearly false fake news story. How about the insanity of the same idiot being able to buy a gun? The real headline should have been, "Another total moron gains access to military-grade weapons." This doesn't bode well for our future, folks. We are entering an era where part of the population can't find factual information but knows exactly where to locate assault rifles with giant mags of ammunition. In America, you still have to take the SATs to get into college, even a junior or community college. How about we require a simple IQ test before you purchase a gun? Some sample multiple-choice questions. I am buying a gun today because A, I can, B, fuck you, C, Nancy Pelosi is making meth in a DC McDonald's bathroom. The Second Amendment is A, our constitutional right to bear arms, B, fuck off, C, a new show from Netflix. "We the people" is a famous phrase from A, the Constitution, B, go fuck yourself, C, Mark Wahlberg. The mainstream media is not the enemy of the American people. Mentally unhinged Americans on the internet are. Conspiracy con man Alex Jones spread the Comet story on his InfoWars website week after week during the 2016 election, and then apologized afterward in a 6-minute video blaming third-party rumors and, quote, "reporters who are no longer with us," unquote. Those so-called reporters are actually just on-set hired hands who scour the internet for crazy theories, print them out, and place the pages in front of Alex, who then randomly decides which ones fit into his daily feverish media feed. Appearing on NBC for a seated interview with Megyn Kelly this past June, a sweaty and twitch-ridden Jones fumbled to explain away the ping-pong fuck-up and his belief that the mass shooting of 20 children and 6 adults at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, was a hoax created by gun control advocates. after Megan's eerily too calm questioning and angry Jones reacted by accusing her of having an agenda. Here's a real news headline for you, Alex. Everybody in the media has an agenda. Megyn Kelly's was to showboat the InfoWars insanity on network television for big Sunday night ratings. Alex's agenda is to scare the shit out of as many Americans as possible so he can sell his latest website products. Gas masks, survival seed vaults, bulletproof backpacks, and other tactical gear you'll need for the impending Armageddon, plus a full array of weight loss supplements. Although, let's be honest, Alex, if we're planting InfoWars survival seeds and swallowing Alex Jones' anti-radiation pills in what may remain of the woods after a biological terror attack, our belly fat will be the first thing to go. New idea, Alex Jones' apocalypse abs. Meet your maker looking like you did in your high school heyday. Slim down for good before you check out forever. Alex believes the government controls our weather with special weapons that can create tornadoes and hurricanes. He also believes government forces blew up the Twin Towers on purpose, not to mention their ongoing plans to turn America gay. The reason there are so many gay people now, Alex explains, is it's a chemical warfare operation. He claims the government is lining juice boxes, water bottles, and potato chip bags with secret formulas that feminize men. And he's been obsessed by the military's development of a, quote, gay bomb, unquote, so powerful it can even turn frogs into homosexuals. Maybe those apocalypse abs are just part of a plot to make Alex more attractive after Armageddon. None of this would matter except for one thing. Our current president is an Alex fan. From the Obama birth theory to an ocean of Hillary for prison t-shirts, Trump has ridden the crazy Alex train for all it's worth, while constantly deriding any actual journalist who criticizes his White House actions. Trump reacts to every negative article written about him with the fragile aplomb of a sensitive thespian. Listen, Mr. President, I get it. I've been working in the theater, concert arenas, and on screen for all of my adult life. I still remember the first positive reviews I received from our college newspaper after the Emerson Comedy Workshop made its stage debut in 1976. Glowing remarks about all of us, but also singling me out for a bit about smoking, a rant against rock stars, a sketch concerning breasts of many sizes, and a satirical song called Chainsaw Love. All the pieces of my No Cure for Cancer comedy persona were already in place. I don't recall the actual words from the article, just the positive vibe, but I do remember phrases from my first negative review a couple of years later, and several from the beginning of my movie career, and the middle, with specific words that still remain in my head. A sampling. Not funny and not fun. Spiky-haired hipster. Dead on arrival. Inane and inept. Why are they still making Dennis Leary movies? Rescue me from watching his long, horsey face. I typed each of those from memory. That's how emblazoned they still are in my brain. Can't recall what I had for lunch yesterday, but the 6 arrows above are still stuck like knives in my neural structure. It happens to everybody in public life. I remember having a wild conversation on the set of Wag the Dog about this when Dustin Hoffman recited his worst review from The Graduate, word for word, 30 years after it was printed. And Willie Nelson recalled a couple of specific sentences that Nashville music critics used to denigrate his voice, face, and songwriting talent at the beginning of his career. Two Hall of Fame level, Grammy-winning, Oscar-owning entertainers with reams of positive press written about them, but only able to remember the worst of the worst. It's human nature to focus in on the detrimental, and in my case, as with Dustin and Willie, use it to fuel the fire, to say fuck you and keep on climbing. Because number one, grabbing a public microphone to call out your critics by name only proves how much they mean to you, transferring the power into their inky, idle, ungifted hands. And number two, maybe they're right. My experience has been that after the initial shock and anger of a bad review, you learn within days if it's true or not. Because if 10 other reviews come out and all say you suck, maybe you do. Temporarily, at least. On the other hand, if 9 reviews come out and say you're a genius, that's not going to last very long either. There isn't an actor, singer, athlete, or politician you can name who hasn't had peaks and valleys in their careers. So I never went on Letterman and called Entertainment Weekly a fake magazine. I also didn't walk out onto Craig Ferguson's set with a copy of the New York Times so I could read a great review of mine out loud. Do I still cringe when bad reviews occur? No, because I stopped reading reviews. I'm 60 years old. What the fuck are they going to say, positive or negative, that I haven't already heard? I suck? Hear it at home when I forget to load the dishwasher. I'm great? I hear that at home when I load the dishwasher and do the laundry. Donald, you are the leader of the free world. Grow the fuck up. I can't even believe I just said that sentence to a 71-year-old man. In case you've forgotten, here's a sampling of the news organizations you have labeled as fake in the last 3 years, in your own words. CNN is fake news. New York Magazine is a piece of garbage. The BBC has no credibility whatsoever. The Huffington Post is fraudulent. Fox News is totally biased and disgusting. NBC News is very dishonest. MSNBC, please, a disaster. CNBC is crazy. The New York Post does false reporting. Time Magazine is biased. Meet the Press is totally dishonest. ABC cannot report the news truthfully. Saturday Night Live isn't funny anymore. That last statement was made about 6 months after you hosted the show and called it fabulous. And you praised Time Magazine this year when they put you on their cover as Person of the Year. Just two examples of how tender and elastic your ego can be. It's fake news when you don't like it, and real news when you do. And the hilarious thing is, you used to create fake news about yourself by calling up New York's gossip columnists, using a fake voice and fake name, and planting fake items about who you were fake fucking. You also hung framed copies of a fake 2009 Time magazine cover featuring a fake photo of your face and a fake headline reading, "The Apprentice is a Television Smash," in the hallways of several Trump golf clubs. In the words of Chris Berman and Mike Ditka, come on, man. You're better than this. Even if you're not, fake it. As evidenced by the LBJ quote that opens this chapter, every president has to endure negative jabs. It comes with the territory. Canceling the traditional POTUS appearance at the White House Correspondents' Dinner just reinforces the idea that you have no sense of humor about yourself. Bad math, brother. The last two Oval Office members who refused to laugh about themselves and their situation were named Nixon and Carter. I feel confident saying these things to you because I know if they don't get published in 140 characters or less, you'll never actually read them. And since you won't, back to the people who bought this book. The thing is, folks, it's fairly easy to identify fake news. Fake headlines would leap right off your computer screen. Trump admits to tiny penis. Or Hillary blames herself. Otherwise, it's all bullshit. Rachel Maddow hates Trump. Sean Hannity blows him on air every night. They both serve up ideology instead of actual news. Talk about an echo chamber. Millions of Americans turn on their TV just to hear their own beliefs reinforced forever, literally going round in the same self-satisfying circle. Where's the middle ground? Anderson Cooper and Chris Wallace, Megyn Kelly and Shepard Smith, they deliver detailed reporting without snarky, partisan sidebars. If your name is Kellyanne Conway and Anderson eye-rolls you live on CNN, it's not because you're a woman. It's because you are spewing fake facts from an alternative universe. He lives on planet Earth. You circle an orange sun, which is where alt media comes in. With 8 million news options online and another partisan batch on screen, each body politic can end up ingesting only what it wishes to find. If you take an audience of white supremacists and feed them white supremacy news from white supremacist reporters, you don't get real news, you get conspiracy theories. I don't believe in white supremacy. Why? I've seen us dance to Coldplay and Kenny G. The thing is, every single second of every single day, you can find news that fits your political needs. They know this. They being the various political companies who need to create different political clickbait that will drive you to their contrasting political websites where advertisers sell the exact same products to everyone. I just Googled Trump should resign. The first headline up is from a site called Politicus USA, and it reads, "Shocking poll shows majority want Trump to resign if his campaign colluded with Russia." Okay, first off, crappy writing. The headline feels longer than the story below it. Second of all, the other headlines on the site's front page include Kellyanne Conway falls flat on her face. Rush Limbaugh falls apart. Trump has mental collapse at press conference. Red state stupidity confirmed. I did not make that last headline up. That's how insanely one-sided this site is. And the top three ads on page one are new pain-free laser hair removal. Three signs of a fatty liver. Win free tickets to see you too. When I Google Obama wiretap Trump, Breitbart pops up first. Here's their headlines. Media darling Obama silent on Trump wiretapping. Alabama passes bill extending stand your ground to armed churchgoers. Lena Dunham says unborn baby a parasite growing inside you. Gender-bending Berkeley murder suspect wants to be referred to as they. And the top three ads are 5 prostate cancer signs. Angioprim, the safe way to clean your arteries and veins. Listen to Whatever It Takes with host Kurt Schilling. Don't be a dunce. They are telling you what you want to hear about politics so you'll buy products that can save your private parts, which is all harmless fun until some Nimrod decides to man up his bad info with an unregistered rifle. Guns don't kill people. People kill people. They just do it a lot faster with the guns we have now, as in around 300 rounds per minute. That's a lot of dead people. And the argument goes, hey, I need this type of weapon in case the bad guys break into my home. If you need an assault rifle that can fire that much ammunition to defend your home, you must be a horrible shot. Unless you're expecting multiple enemies with weapons as big as yours, in which case, you have to be a giant fucking asshole. I'm pro-gun and pro-gun control, and I'm not an anomaly. I believe in the right to bear arms, but I'm tired of hearing the NRA and other gun nuts pointing at the Second Amendment and any moderation of it as being commie pinko liberal propaganda. It's just common goddamn sense. When you can no longer go see Iron Man 4 without carrying 2 Glocks along with your popcorn, the answer isn't selling raisinettes and extra rounds. When our children can't go to school without fear of getting shot, the solution isn't handing each kid a Kevlar vest and an AK-47. When gun violence and deaths increase year after year, the cure isn't coming up with even bigger bullets. No place is safe or sacred anymore. Not school, not work, not even church. And now, they're coming after baseball. But the Steve Scalise shooting didn't result in tighter gun laws. It resulted in the NRA and its supporters asking to have every single member of the House and Senate fully armed with automatic weapons. This argument is offered up after every mass shooting in America. More guns and more bullets. If we give into that gruesome urge, eventually, everybody in America is going to have a gat on them everywhere they go, including the ballpark. Let's face it, folks. That might be our near future. The cycle of grief and astonishment we go through after each mass shooting grows shorter and more shallow as their frequency increases. So it's not that hard to imagine an America where we all have weapons 24/7. It might lead to a higher body count, but hey, look at the bright side. It would make baseball a hell of a lot more exciting. Think you're a tough out? Try stealing second base when the catcher is carrying. Not too many guys are going to rush the mound if the pitcher has a pistol. You want a slow trot around the diamond after a massive home run? You better be wearing a bulletproof batting helmet, pal. Let's arm the umpires, too. Guys will play a lot fucking faster under threat of a flesh wound. Forget stats like hit by pitch. Hit by 44 Magnum will be way more impressive. We may one day actually hear Joe Buck say, he's not just throwing heat out there, he's packing it. And golf? I think it blows. But who wouldn't want to watch if there were snipers hidden on random holes? Turbocharged golf carts and exploding balls. 9 irons and 9 millimeters. You could play all 18 holes in less than an hour and a half. What'd you get in that hole, Dennis? A double bogey and some shrapnel in my shoulder. Trust me, no one's going to waste time looking for a lost top flight when the woods are full of Smith and Wessons. At the time our founding fathers created the Second Amendment, and specifically the right to bear arms, the only weapons available were muskets and cannons. Muskets shot one metal ball at a time. Each ball could only travel about 75 yards and was often apt to veer off wildly once it left the barrel of the gun. And muskets took almost a full minute to reload. In other words, they sucked, and so did your chances of survival, because it only took about 12 seconds for your still untouched target to run up and eviscerate you with his trusty old-fashioned sword. Now, clearly the Founding Fathers would gladly take an assault rifle from any one of us if we flew back in time and handed them one. But saying a law written on December 15th, 1791 should still apply word for word on December 15th, 2017 is like saying today's drunk driving law should be the same as the one that existed in 1909. Spoiler alert, there was no law against driving drunk in 1909. There were also no stop signs, traffic lights, or seat belts. You want to go back in time to that kind of mayhem? I didn't think so. We can keep on bemoaning the battalion of bullets that fly each time some psychopath gets his hands on a modern musket and takes out an army of innocent people, and then respond by constantly rearming ourselves. Or we can spend good money making it harder, if not impossible, for mentally deranged maniacs to get weapons of war. These people all seem to have the same backstory, lack of necessary medication. Problem is, they can walk into Walmart and buy a weapon anytime they want. But Zoloft? Whoa, slow down there, buddy. You gotta go see a doctor to get your hands on something that dangerous. In many states, it's actually easier to buy a rifle than it is a bottle of Robitussin DM. It's enough to make you have a massive anxiety attack every time you have to leave the house. But fear not, we have some new drugs for that. I never had a problem with drugs. I had problems with the police. Keith Richards. New drugs we really need. America has been on the cutting edge of prescription medication for decades, creating pills to put down any demons that dare threaten our pursuit of happiness. And when pills won't work, the USA still has our back. For instance, scientific and medical research have solved seasonal affective disorder, SAD, by developing and prescribing the light therapy lamp, LTL. You turn it on and sit near it for a few hours a day, and voila, just feel the positive new vibes popping into your brainstem. Here's a helpful hint. You don't need to buy any LTLs, because you already have a ton of them in your house. They're called fucking lamps. From here on out, known as FLs, okay? Whenever modern medicine identifies a marketable disease, it automatically creates a cool three-letter nickname to make it sound more serious. For instance, if enough of us complained that we no longer cared about anyone's opinion, and that seemed to be a problem for family members and friends, within about 6 months, doctors would have a trademark name as well as some pills and a light fixture to treat it with. I'm calling it Zero Fucks Disease, ZFD, and I ain't seeking a cure. As of this writing, the USA swallows 80% of the world's opioid supply, and 62% of that supply is legally obtained. The two most popular forms are OxyContin and Vicodin. Methadone came in a close third but fell asleep before the finish line. We have so many people on doctor-prescribed opioids that rather than wean patients off of them, which doesn't turn a profit, doctors are now developing new diseases based on the symptoms of opioid abuse, one of which has a cool-sounding name, OIC. Opioid-induced constipation, which is basically what killed Elvis. The king of rock and roll was sitting on his master bathroom throne trying to take a shit when he died, which is a shame, because if he could have just remained a living, breathing junkie for another 40 years, 2017 would have moved his bowels for him with the new miracle drug, Movantik. Yep, they actually put part of the word move right in the title. Movantik makes your body take a giant crap. It also has a long list of side effects, including headache, stomach pain, diarrhea, intestinal perforation, anxiety, irritability, sweating, chills, yawning, dizziness with fainting, and nausea with fainting. Remarkably, OxyContin and Vicodin have the exact same list of side effects with only one difference. You can't take a shit. Hello, Movantik. God, if they had only approached cocaine and alcohol abuse this way, then instead of talking aimlessly for hours on end, cocaine overabundance condition, and burning off brain cells with booze, alcohol submersion syndrome, I could have kept on partying until my kidneys gave out. Deficient intestinal kinesis. Hey, motherfucker, I'm not some random drunken cokehead. I have cock, ass, and dick. As long as America is curing its bathroom issues, we might as well solve several others that need to be addressed. So, while you're waiting for ballooning pro-Obamacare to morph into mysterious Trump tax incentive care, you will at least be a happier and healthier person, mainly because you'll be high as a kite, high enough to develop ZFD. As a celebrity doctor, I'm prescribing these new drugs. Blame it all. Are you having trouble at work? Unable to stay in a lasting romantic relationship? Do your family members and ex-friends tell you what a failure you are and why? Guess what? It's your own fucking fault. Two pills a day and you will stop pointing fingers at your parents, the government, bad luck, and fate. You'll come to realize it wasn't Obama who was holding you back. It was a giant case of denial with a legal weed and Cheeto chaser. You didn't vote for Trump and Pence or Clinton and Kane. Nope, you chose the Game of Thrones and apathy ticket. No more aimless whining. No more pointless plans. Blame it all. We'll solve it all. Side effects include getting off your fat ass and finally doing something. Alternifax. Up is down, wrong is right, losing is winning, and everyone adores you. Spew fake data you just made up. Like this, a new poll says 73% of Americans love your hair. Who took the poll? You did. When? Who gives a fuck? No side effects. Why? Because you said so. Mexico. Makes illegal aliens realize what a mess this country is and urgently wish to deport themselves. Side effects include building a giant wall that keeps American tourists out of your birth nation. And getting Eric Trump to pay for it. Selenoid. Cures the addiction to Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, and every other idiotic social site or digital app. Makes you only use your phone for what it really is. A fucking phone. Side effects include eye contact and intimacy. Phobigon. Find yourself hating anyone who isn't white like you? Afraid of minorities, gays, feminists, and the future? Don't worry. Take one Phobigon tonight and wake up tomorrow loving every member of the LGBTQ community. Not to mention straight women, black people, Jews, Mexicans, Muslims, hell, everybody on earth. Side effects include can't listen to Rush Limbaugh without puking. Conservator. One dose a day and you'll not only know how to avoid paying taxes, but believe every single thing that comes out of Sean Hannity's mouth. Curse Ted Koppel. Cherry-pick negative Obama video clips from 9 years ago. Build a Corey Lewandowski shrine in your backyard. Side effects may include a sudden desire to blow Scott Baio. Obamaline. Restores your faith in hope and change, which actually no longer exist. But you won't give a shit. You'll be too busy giving wonderful speeches full of poetic phrases and handing out free healthcare cards while you golf. Side effects include helping Hillary sell Bernie Was My Bitch t-shirts outside the Chappaqua Starbucks. Bronzatone. You turn tan. Permanently. And look just as vigorous and vital as our president. Minus the tanning bed goggle lines around the eyes. Complimentary lavender lip gloss included, along with a Make Mar-a-Lago Great Again hat. No known side effects. Okay, one. You may have the urge to tweet random thoughts at 4:30 a.m. Fight them off with this. Twitter ban. Kills the desire to tweet. Instead, you actually read books and gain interesting and true historical information that makes you smarter. Side effects may include finger shrinkage and higher IQ. Ivanka paid. Makes you sell, 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 24/7, 365. Shoes, scarves, dresses, and anything else you wear on 60 Minutes or to a NATO summit. Side effects include inability to smile while meeting the Pope because he refused to buy a blouse. Plus, his ring is bigger than yours. Comadrill. Places you in an 8-year-long sleep state so you can rest your sensitive bones and awake to the soothing sounds of our next president, Ted Danson. Or Ted Nugent. In either case, you can take another 2-term dose. Side effects include sometimes answering to the name Norm and or bow-hunting liberals. Americaine. It's just blow, but it comes in a red, white, and blue little bottle. And you may not be in a coma, but you'll feel so goddamn happy for the next 4 years, you won't give a fuck who the president is. Prescription blow is medicinal marijuana's bigger, louder brother, and he loves to party. Side effects include sudden death due to massive heart attack. But hey, if you voted for Hillary, that's probably a plus in your book right now. First, God created man. Then, he had a better idea. Sister Agnes Catherine, 1973. In God We Suck. We've all seen the bumper stickers and the hashtag with the letters WWJD, meaning, what would Jesus do? For one thing, not run for president and get elected in this country. First of all, there's that murky relationship with the scandalous Mary Magdalene. And when that wasn't biting him in the ass, there's another ripe territory for his opponents to point at. A 33-year-old man who's not married and hangs around with 12 guys who follow him wherever he goes? Sounds either too gay or too gangster for many voters. And his liberal views on lepers and sinners will hurt him in many conservative circles, not to mention feeding large crowds with free food. What is he, some kind of socialist? And then there's that nickname, King of the Jews, which means he can count on New York and California, but the rest of the country? Not so much. Jew-S-A. Jew-S-A. And let's not forget about all the beards. People don't mind beards on baseball players, but when you're running for the highest office in the land, a cabinet full of hairy-faced guys in togas and sandals just ain't gonna cut it. And even the voters in New York and L.A. will wince about the lack of women and black people on that posse. This is before we even get into tax returns for a guy who hasn't held a paid position in his life. And what's his motto going to be? Worship my father? Jesus would be denigrated as God's puppet, and I can just hear the TV pundits now. Too preachy. Too whiny. Bottomless jug of wine? Is this guy a candidate or a keyboard player? Jethro Tull called. He wants his hair cut back. I have one question for this supposed son of God. Why isn't your father running? If there is a God, I hope he's a she. Just to see the look on the faces of all the men who've spent centuries declaring war in his name when they show up at the pearly gates to find her staring dolefully back at them. Talk about an uh-oh moment. Every single organized religion ever created on this planet has come up with rules to subjugate, repress, and control women. Their minds, bodies, and emotions. Not to mention birth cycles. Plus, the right to vote, marry, and work. To this very day, women in America still fight for equal pay and consideration in business locations and government offices across the land. I'm tired of it, and I have a penis. The Bible, the Koran, the Torah, each is chock full of rules and regulations that in so-called strict interpretation somehow manage to justify men killing each other in their chosen deity's name, but won't allow women to express an opinion, or show some leg, or drive. And every time we hold an election in the USA, we have to listen to a tankload of bullshit from conservative candidates about what God wants for America and how God sees the law and why God hates gay marriage and blah, blah, biblical blah. Here's the thing. It's 2017. The geniuses who now want to uproot the separation of church and state built into our Constitution by the Founding Fathers are the same assholes who claim the Second Amendment can't be altered by one iota. They break open their Bibles and claim it answers every question ever asked. And it probably did, back in 1205 BC. Which is apparently what year it still is in Henniger, Alabama. Where last March, a woman named Carol Laney, owner of the Henniger Drive-In Movie Theater, raised a ruckus about Disney's latest live-action version of Beauty and the Beast. Okay, I may have exaggerated when I said it was still 1205 BC in this town, but a drive-in? Sounds like Henniger's clocks got stopped during the Kennedy administration. The town's motto is, building a future, preserving the past. And they clearly ain't kidding about that second part. After Carol booked the movie based on the poster, she was horrified to find out that the actor Josh Gad's character, LeFou, has what barely register as a few, quote-unquote, gay moments on screen. When director Bill Condon announced that LeFou was in fact Disney's first officially gay character and a tribute to the lyricist Howard Ashman, who died of AIDS shortly after working on the animated original, Carol went off the rails and refused to show the new film. Here's the statement that she released. When companies continually force their views on us, we need to take a stand. We all make choices, and I am making mine. For those who do not know, Beauty and the Beast is premiering their first homosexual character. The producer also says at the end of the movie there will be a surprise for same-sex couples. This is by no means sending a message of hatred and bigotry. However, we are Christians first and foremost and must adhere to the Bible and its teachings. We hope you will come and support the Henniger Drive-In, maybe not for this movie, but for others. Even though we do not condone the decision of the producers in Beauty and the Beast, does not mean that we hate anyone. We know God will bless this endeavor. If we cannot take our 11-year-old granddaughter and 8-year-old grandson to see a movie, we have no business watching it. If I can't sit through a movie with God or Jesus sitting by me, then we have no business showing it. I know there will be some who disagree with our decision. That's fine. We are first and foremost Christians. We will not compromise on what the Bible teaches. Okay, first and foremost, I guess Jesus and God must really dig the Boss Baby, Despicable Me 3, and Hidden Figures, which were all scheduled to play at Carol's Drive-In as of this writing. Although it's a bummer Jesus and his dad don't review movies in advance. Can you imagine what a box office boost your family-friendly film would get if it received 4 halos from those two? Not to mention how great no halos would be if you were marketing a twisted indie aimed at atheists. Plus, Jesus and his dad at the movies is a kick-ass name for a film review TV show. The ratings would be huge. I've got the advertising one-liner. Watch us or die. Your choice. Second of all, back to Carol. She must be a pretty fucking special lady if Jesus and God both request that they sit with her during Ice Age 1 through 5. Religious zealots always think God is not only on their side, but literally at their side. Musicians who thank God when they win a Grammy, actors who invoke the Lord as they clutch a trophy, baseball players who point at the sky and bless themselves after eking out a single, or George Bush Jr., who thought God was always speaking directly to him during his White House years. If God were truly that involved in each of these lives, wouldn't it only make sense that Satan would have a hold on some public souls? I would love to listen to this post-game interview on ESPN. I'd like to thank Satan for letting me hit that grand slam and also for giving the other team's best reliever leukemia so I could face their backup guy. My third point about Carol. She mentions that old standby, quote, what the Bible teaches us, unquote, which is religious code for God hates gays, or, at the very least, didn't create them, or created them by mistake. I always get so confused when we get into this kind of religion-based science. And Carol makes it very clear that her decision, quote, does not mean that we hate anyone, unquote. Oh, thank God. And his son. So it's not hate. It's just a massive amount of bigoted backwards fear that her granddaughter and grandson would somehow become homosexuals if they were exposed to an, quote, alternative lifestyle, unquote, character in a major motion picture. Carol, let me update you on the most current mode of conversion therapy. Everyone knows if your kids turn gay while watching a swishy Disney movie, you just rush them across town into a ballsy Jason Statham action flick and boom, they're back to being straight again. That's why we need Vin Diesel in the Fast and Furious franchise, to keep our kids from doing musicals. God forbid your grandkids see Josh Gad dancing for 8 seconds when they could be watching Dwayne Johnson blow shit up for 97 minutes. Everything I love and hate about America is contained in Carol's story. A citizen using her right of free speech to silence the free speech of another citizen while expressing her religious beliefs to throw shade at the sexual identity of an estimated 15 million Americans, give or take the 2 million conservative Christians who still haven't come out of the closet yet. That last stat is me exercising my right to make a pretty safe assumption. Shortly after shit-canning Beauty, Carol announced that her drive-in would be showing the movie Fierce, a story about British drag queens and their fight for equality. Sudden enlightenment on her part? Nope. Carol booked it based on the poster, which she said showed, quote, a woman surrounded by dragons that made it look like a Game of Thrones type of thing, unquote. She was shocked to find out it wasn't. So Carol was fine with kids watching rape, incest, and beheadings, plus people being eaten by dogs or burned alive. Fire-breathing dragons, yes, but fiery drag queens singing show tunes? How dare you? Hey, Carol, I hate to break the news, but Disney movies have been chock full of unofficially gay characters for decades now, okay? The Genie in Aladdin, Ken in Toy Story, same-sex couple Chip and Dale, and possibly the entire cast of Mary Poppins have all struck a rainbow coalition chord with some discerning audiences. Think about it for a second. Mary hates Mr. Banks but crushes on his wife. Plus, Bert flirts with Mary far too much for a man who likes climbing filthy chimneys to join rooftop dance jams with 20 other guys. And let's not forget the glorious gay underpinnings of so many other animated icons. Ariel, Ursula, Belle, Mulan, Hades, Prince Eric, Turkina, Governor Ratcliffe, Oaken, Timon, Pumbaa, Elsa, and Dory. Whew, guess that puts a little crimp in your Christ-like screenings. Far be it from me to tell anyone how to live their lives, but hey, this is my book, and I'm getting tired of science as taught by people who don't believe in climate change or Neil Patrick Harris, and who only read one book written 9,000 years ago. So here I go. The Ten Commandments are not only out of date, but almost impossible to completely obey. Unless you're Faith Hill. Or a monk. And they don't apply practically to modern life anymore. But fret not, folks. I have an option. And it's specifically geared to the world we live in now. The 12 Commandments. Number 1. Thou shalt not kill. Number 2. Unless someone threatens to kill you first. Number 3. In which case, be my guest. 4. Thou shalt actively covet thy neighbor's spouse. 5. Let's face it, you're going to do it anyway. 6. Just don't fuck him or her. 7. Google a porn star who looks like the person. 8. Have at it. 9. Help others, not to Google porn, to eat, educate, and better themselves, or to survive in times of crisis, especially after natural disasters and during medical emergencies, or even when they have a flat tire. It's called charity. Do it as often as possible. Why? 10. Because it will cancel out the killing and the coveting. 11. don't be a douche. 12. Speaking of 11, don't try to sneak 11 items into the 10 items or less line. Even Jesus knows this is a dick move. That's it. If you can't follow those simple 12 steps, then you're a piece of shit. And you can't be in my church, which I'm calling Our Lady of Shut the Fuck Up. Each week we gather for an hour and listen to someone great make a speech on a subject we all need to learn more about. There's no texting, emailing, or Q&A afterward. No screaming over someone else because you don't like what they're saying. Shut the fuck up and listen. Thus the church title. When it comes to the seven deadly sins, they also need to be dragged kicking and screaming into the current century. They were collected and enumerated by Pope Gregory I in 602 AD and almost immediately became a box office bonanza. So much so that he was nicknamed Gregory the Great. Here's the official list in descending nastiness as he ranked them. 1. Pride. 2. Envy. 3. Wrath. 4. Sloth. 5. Greed. 6. Gluttony. And 7. Lust. That's a Game of Thrones season finale, or any episode of Rescue Me. And President Trump's tweets involve at least 3 of these sins per day. Me? I probably compose 2 to 4 sinful tweets per week, so let's call that a wash. See, I employed one of the 7 heavenly virtues there. I cut Trump some slack. Never heard of the 7 heavenly virtues? Well, strap yourself in, because a guy named Aurelius Prudentius came up with them in 410 AD, beating Greg the First's sin list by a couple hundred years. Here they are. 1. Modesty. 2. Mercy. 3. Grace. 4. Passion. 5. Charity. 6. Prudence. 7. Chastity. Sounds like the dance lineup from a really hip strip club. Now, I did 13 years in the Catholic prison system, and I never heard one word about this virtues thing. I asked around, and none of my friends were aware of them either. That's because PG1 decided AP's goody-two-shoes approach was lame. For 2 solid centuries, the virtues weren't helping the Holy Vatican Bank get bigger revenues, and old Greggy figured out why. When it comes to religion, lowly sin sells way better than high self-esteem. You can't nicely ask a Sunday congregation to please try harder at practicing the 7 heavenly virtues and then expect them to fork over their cash. Everybody in the crowd's going to identify at least one virtue they've used during the course of the last week. Plus, the words are all too happy. Virtue, practice, heaven. That's a buyer's market. But if you warn them in a scary voice to stop committing the 7 deadly sins before their evil souls burn in an eternal hell, they'll break out their wallets and beg for forgiveness with $5 bills. Thus did PGG begin raising godly gazillions for Vatican City. Fear, baby. That's what really sells. Turning the 7 heavenly virtues into their exact opposites was a genius move. And which flick would you rather see? The one where Charlize Theron plays the modest and merciful social worker? Or the one where she's a hot spy in a miniskirt who kicks ass while flashing some side boob? Put me down for the second, which I'll watch at least 3 times. Now, by my count, Carol Laney's statement contained 2 of the deadly sins, pride and wrath. But if she had practiced even just one of the virtues, let's say mercy, kindness, or even some grace, patience, she might have had the opportunity to listen and learn something about her different but still fellow human beings, which is what I believe Jesus would have done, right after he finished watching Captain Underpants with Carol at his favorite hangout, the Henniger Drive-In. Now listen, I'm not pointing a finger, I'm giving the finger, both of my middle fingers, to all the Bible-quoting, psalm-tweeting, evolution-denying, holier-than-thou amateur theists trying to make the rest of us kowtow to their personal beliefs. You have every right to express the notion that we should bow before this big voice in the sky because some cute blonde chick made it mad by taking a bite out of an apple eons ago. But the great thing about America is this. Tons of us think that story sounds an awful lot like a fucking Disney movie. And the Founding Fathers put a panic room in the political system to keep it safe from such animated ideology. And by the way, it works, especially when it comes to cash. North Carolina is expected to lose $4 billion in the next 10 years due to the state government's ignorant refusal to recognize the bathroom rights of the LGBTQ community. That's got to be the most expensive religious piss ever taken. And just so you know, while I'm giving 2 middle fingers to the Bible fanatics, there's another 8 fingers pointing right back at me. I ain't no angel. I got kicked out of the altar boys of St. Peter's Parish for drinking the holy wine, and then demoted to the choir, where I lasted a few weeks, until I got caught smoking in the choir balcony during a break between Palm Sunday songs. So in your eyes,